Welcome back. For the home stretch, at least for me, I guess the clocks continue, but by somebody else. So today I'm going to talk about proteins, mostly having talked mostly about DNA yesterday morning and mostly about RNA yesterday afternoon. I'm going to start off talking about protein synthesis, how you go from the RNA sequence to the protein sequence, that is the genetic code. Talk a little bit about protein structure and function, although I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about that. That ends up being one of the topics that's coming up in the next few weeks. It's also not an area that I work in myself, so I'm just going to kind of give you the basics. As in the other lectures, the whole purpose of these talks is really to introduce you to sort of basic molecular biology stuff without going into a lot of detail. Those will come up in the latter part of the semester. I think this morning's lecture will actually be shorter than some of the other ones, although if the questions and discussion make it longer, that's fine with me too. Maybe at the end, actually, we can maybe start a discussion about, you know, where's the physics in all this, or where what the relationship is between what I've told you. And I'm sure that's a discussion that will continue on over the course of the whole semester, but it's already come up in some of my conversations with people, and so maybe we can start something on that today as well. All right, let me go back to the central dogma again to introduce today's talk, and just point out the differences between prokaryotes and eukaryotes. So prokaryotes are generally bacteria. The differences are they don't have a nucleus. Everything is happening in one compartment. And so in some sense, this central dogma is a straightforward transfer of information from the DNA sequence through the messenger RNA sequence. And we talked about that yesterday. And then finally, a messenger RNA sequence is translated into the protein sequence. In eukaryotes, as I mentioned before, it's a little more complicated. The DNA sequence gets first transcribed into a pre-messenger RNA sequence, written here just simply as mRNA. And then there's a process of removing introns. So you get, doesn't show up very well on this figure, but they're introns that get taken out, and then the remaining part of the sequence, which is called the exons, the introns and the exons, the introns get removed, the exons get spliced back together to give you the final messenger RNA, which then gets translated. But notice that this circle right here represents the nucleus. So the initial part, the transcription events, all happen inside the nucleus, and then the final messenger RNA gets exported out of the nucleus and gets translated in the cytoplasm. So the two steps, transcription and translation, are actually in separate compartments, which is one of the fundamental differences, and actually, in some ways, it makes the process over here a little more complicated in how you get to this point. But at this point, now you've separated those two processes, and so it actually simplifies things to some extent compared to what happens at prokaryotes. I'll show you an example of that in a few minutes. Let me just put up a structure of a typical gene. I don't know if there is such a thing as a typical gene, but an example from a, I think this is actually it's just a, you know, let's say a typical eukaryotic gene showing that the overall length of the DNA that gets transcribed into RNA is about 7,000 base pairs. But within that 7,000 base pairs, what are listed here is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. So those are the exons, and what are listed is A, B, C, D, E, F, and G. Those are the introns. And so when this piece of DNA gets initially transcribed into the RNA, it of course contains both the exons and the introns. Some additional things happen. It gets added to the 5' end, a so-called cap. I'm not going to describe, but it's just a signal that gets put onto the 5' end of the message. And there's some extra RNA at the end that's also going to get chopped off. So what's shown here is that the introns are removed, this extra RNA at the end gets removed, and in the end you end up with the final messenger RNA, which only contains the exons. And then typically there gets added what's called a poly-A tail on the end. So the message, final eukaryotic message, has a cap at the 5' end, a single protein coding region within it, and then a poly-A tail. And I just mention that because you'll undoubtedly hear those words described when people talk about messenger RNAs and eukaryotes. And so, to point out what they're referring to by those words. Just a little bit more about the process of splicing, which I introduced yesterday. I mentioned the... Oh, sorry. This one or this first one here? Okay, I can leave that up there. We talked about the splicing a little bit yesterday, and I just mentioned again. Let me just give a little more detail. So if... I mentioned yesterday, so what's shown here is in this line along the bottom here represents a pre-mRNA. So this is the original transcript off of the DNA. And what's highlighted here in the yellow part is just the intron sequence goes from that junction to that junction. And what's being highlighted here is the process. I mentioned that there were these signals that tell you where the beginning of the intron is and where the end of the intron is, and those signals are actually embedded in the RNA sequence, the pre-messenger RNA sequence. And in fact, what's shown here is these U1 and U2. These are other RNAs. These are part of, there's a machine called a spliceosome. Remember before we talked about ribosomes and all these things. So there's this molecular machine called a spliceosome, and it contains RNAs within it. And you can see that this RNA, which is part of the spliceosome called U1, actually makes base pairing with this signal, and that's part of the signal that tells it where the intron begins, and there's another base pairing event that happens down here that tells it where the end of the intron is. So this machine can recognize introns based on these signals. It binds to them, cuts them out, and then takes the two lead ends here and fuses them back together. So the whole process of this machine is to eventually get rid of this intron going down here and fuse together the exons. What? The green represents the final exon, and the yellow represents the intron. Okay, and the same thing is true down here. So the intron ends here, begins here. The exon, so there's one exon here, there's probably another exon upstream, and there might be lots of exons in this particular messenger. I've just focused in on one particular intron and just showing you the fact that there are these signals here and here that are going to end up being cleaved out so that in the end it goes through this process down here, sort of showing you the final step where everything has been assembled. And these balls here represent the spliceosome machinery. They end up removing the intron. The two exons get fused together to give you the final messenger RNA shown down here, and the intron goes away. Yeah, so what I mentioned yesterday was, let me put up this as an example, although unfortunately, the Xeroxing didn't come out very clear. So this would be, as I said, a quote, typical gene in which there's a set of exons and a set of introns, and through processing, you would usually find that all of the introns are removed and all of the exons get put together to give you one gene. So this would be a case where a single gene gave rise to a single protein product. There are other examples which are referred to generally by the term alternative splicing, which means that, in fact, there might be, and alternative splicing comes in various ways. So one way to do alternative splicing is that instead of just removing this intron, for instance, because remember there's a signal here that says this is the beginning of an intron, and there's a signal here that says this is the end of an intron. There's also a signal here that says it's a beginning and here's an end. And usually you would just cut out E and you would cut out F separately, but you might imagine that sometimes, either by mistake or in fact on purpose, that sometimes it would jump from this beginning to this ending, and it would take out E, F, and the intervening exon as a single unit. Then you would end up with a protein product which is different. Now in this case, the protein product would be only slightly different. It would have exons 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, and 7, and it would be missing exon 5. That's one way to do alternative splicing, is a so-called exon skipping mechanism. There are other ways in which these signals that I was mentioning either can be hidden in some way, so I could imagine that there's a protein that comes in and covers up this piece of RNA so that the spliceosome can't see it, and that's a way you can regulate splicing. And so I could make it such that it simply doesn't see a particular intron, and then it splices it in an alternative method. And in the end, it's possible that instead of there being one process, so given an initial transcript, instead of there being only one way to remove introns, there might be multiple ways in which introns can be removed, so that at the end I might end up with different messenger RNA sequences, which would then code for different proteins based on a single region of DNA. So that's this issue that we brought up yesterday about whether the definition of a gene, whether a single DNA piece, even though it might make multiple products, corresponds to one gene or multiple genes. And you raised the issue, well, if there's only one DNA and there's only one genetic code, how can you make multiple products? So the way you make multiple products is by having alternative ways of splicing out introns. And initially, when this was first discovered, it was discovered actually, I think initially in Drosophila, and it was sort of an unusual case. I thought, well, maybe this is a special event. Maybe there are certain cases in which you might regulate splicing. It turned out to be much more common than people originally thought. And the most recent estimates I've heard are something that maybe 50% of human genes actually have more than one splice product at the end. And that ends up leading to this issue of, well, are there really 35,000 genes or are there really 80,000 genes? That's part of the issue. That's not the entire issue. But part of the issue is you count a gene as one protein product, or if a single piece of DNA gets to multiple protein products, is that one gene or multiple genes? That's part of the issue. Yeah. I don't know of any cases where you ever switch exon order around. So as far as I know, this process proceeds linearly. So again, this figure is just showing you one intron. But in general, the intron, you move it from here to here, and the exons get ligated back together in order. And you can leave them out or something, but you never switch the order. At least I don't know of any examples of that. Now, introns can be very, very large. Typically, like, so this I said is a typical gene. Well, what does that mean? I mean, this gene, the transcript is about 7,000 base pairs. Maybe in the end, about half of that is exon sequence and half of it was intron sequence. There are genes that have absolutely enormous introns. There are genes that have a single intron that might be 100,000 base pairs long. And there are, in fact, examples. And again, we'll know a lot more as we start analyzing the complete genome. But these are things that, so far, that it's been seen once. We don't know whether it's sort of a general principle or not. There are actually cases where I can have a very large gene with a very big intron in it, and that intron actually has another gene within it. Okay, that is, within the DNA, there's a promoter in that region that makes for maybe a small transcript, and that can actually lead to a gene, sometimes in the other orientation from the main gene. So there is actually precedence for overlapping genes, although it's, at the moment, relatively rare. But you could imagine that if I have a big, giant stretch of intron sequence, there might be other things going on within that sequence. There are a few examples of that. It's simply not known at this point how common that is, or if it's a really rare event. These recognition sequences are fairly, well, I don't know what you mean, very highly conserved. This GU is almost completely conserved, and the AG is almost completely conserved. The rest of the nucleotides here, you know, you can make a consensus sequence. It's sort of like the pattern I showed yesterday, where there are some positions that are essentially completely conserved and other positions that are more variable. But even if this entire stretch was completely conserved, that's only a 6-nucleotide. That's not enough. Well, counting the AG, it would be 8 nucleotides. That's going to occur on average about every 4,000 base pairs. The question is that enough information? If you have an intron that's 100,000 base pairs long, and you have a signal that occurs on average every 5,000 or 10,000 base pairs, that's clearly not enough information. There must be some more information in there somewhere. But the general question of how conserved are these patterns, it actually varies from species to species. This particular pattern right here, this is called the branch point, because during the removal of this intron, this A, this gets bulged out here, actually gets made into a loop. So it's called a branch point. Anyway, that's sort of beside the point. This pattern is very highly conserved in yeast, and in human it's only weakly conserved. So human actually has bigger introns on average than yeast does. So there must be some other information that we're not quite picking up on. It may well be that part of the important information for splicing is in the messenger RNA here shown as just a linear string, but it's undoubtedly folding. I mean, remember, RNA sequences can make structures. and the probability of it not making a stretch edge is very low. I mean, it's just internally sticky. It's like taking out a big piece of scotch tape and going like this. It's going to stick to itself just because it's a sticky surface, right? So it undoubtedly has some structure, and it's what's not clear is if for messenger RNAs, if that structure is really important to its function or not. For some of the RNAs, like I talked about tRNAs and some other ones, the structure is clearly very important. For messenger RNAs, the important function of that is, of course, coding for the protein. They undoubtedly have some structure, but whether that structure is actually important or not, we don't know in general. It could be that it's actually involved in and important picking out where the real splice sites are, that you know the mRNA overall folds up to present the splice site boundaries in some way that they can be easily recognized. But I think that's an open question. Well, because the point that the protein recognizes may not be this exact sequence, because if this sequence was conserved, then you'd say, well, it'd cover up all of them. It might recognize a sequence that's up here slightly, or maybe even overlapping, but if a protein binds here, it will block the access to this. So, in other words, the point that this other protein could provide specificity is in a neighboring sequence, but just because the sequence it binds to and then how big the protein is, it may actually block access to that. So you can get, there are examples, actually, of proteins. Usually, the example I know about, or the two or three that I know about, the protein binding site is actually in here, between these two parts of the signal. The protein binds here, but in so doing, it prevents the spliceosome from binding to that same site, and therefore leads to alternatively spliced genes. So this protein is only expressed in certain cells, and so in those cells, instead of making the normal product, you make a different product. Right? It has, well, it will have some things in common, but different. I mean, first of all, the RNA is somewhat single-stranded and somewhat double-stranded. So the protein that binds to it, it may recognize partly double-stranded sequence, but actually most RNA binding proteins, the sequence specificity comes in binding to the single-stranded regions, which actually gives you a bigger surface to bind to. So most RNA binding proteins, specificity comes in single-stranded regions, not double-stranded regions.
In this scenario that you mentioned, that there is a gene cluster, there is a parasite. That can really, not just the speculative, but then
they get digested and the nucleotides get reused again. That's a really good question. There are two schools of thought. The one is the introns early school. That is, introns actually existed way back in the beginning of evolution, and sort of life evolved around introns. The other speculation is that introns are a late event, sort of similar to viruses. They're a parasite that sort of jumped into DNA, and as long as there exists some mechanism for them to get out of DNA, it doesn't really cause a detriment to the cell. Of course, if they jumped into the middle of a gene and there wasn't any way to excise them, then it would basically just kill the organism that it jumped into, and there wouldn't be any way for the intron to propagate itself. But if it has a way to jump in and jump back out, then it could be propagated without being detrimental to the cell. And so that's one of the reasons that, you know, again, this is, I think, speculative, and I'm not a leading expert in the field by any means, but some of the speculation is that if you believe in the model that that these introns are essentially parasitic DNA that has jumped into genomes, that the original ones all had to be these self-splicing introns that would jump in and they had a way to splice themselves out. Now over time, the cell evolved ways to make that even more efficient, to get rid of the introns even more efficiently. And then eventually, you end up with introns like these that no longer have the ability to splice themselves out. They now rely on the cell's mechanism to remove them. But as long as that's efficient enough, again, it doesn't really cause a detriment to the cell.
Yeah. So this is similar to what you mentioned in introns.
Well, not necessarily introns, but catalytic RNA. I mean, RNA has been shown now to have both catalytic activities, which we usually prescribe to proteins, and it also has information capability. And so you could imagine that there were RNAs early on that essentially evolved the ability to replicate themselves. Okay, so that, and that's the essence of life, to be able to replicate yourself. So you could imagine that an RNA is the most likely candidate for a single molecule that has the ability to replicate itself. That's the basis of it. I mean, you can go much farther beyond that in terms of speculation, but that's the basic underlying idea.
Right?
I think for most of these introns and nucleates, there isn't any evidence for that. They now, if they ever had that kind of information, it's basically been pared down and thrown away. In yeast, the typical size of an intron is actually quite small. It's about 50 to 70 base pairs. It doesn't have a lot of information in it. As far as we can tell, it doesn't have really much structure. If it is the remnant of an early event, basically all the everything's been thrown away except the signals that are left there to pop it out again. Exons turn into introns. I don't think there's any strong evidence for that, but one could imagine that might happen. There are certainly things called pseudogenes, where an entire gene has been inactivated and it now is just junk DNA. You could imagine that would happen to a single exon within a gene, and now that, what used to be an exon, is no longer functional and has now become part of an intron. It could happen at the gene level. I think that's plausible, if you're in the school where you think that introns were very early on in evolution, and we talked yesterday about one of the ways to get diversity is the so-called exon shuffling model. You can imagine that introns might have an advantage. It might provide an advantage for doing exon shuffling kinds of things. Give you basically bigger targets in which to do exchanges and put things together. And so that's one of the arguments that people in that camp view that might be reasonable. But there are also nowadays there are clear purposes that some introns are put to. This alternative splicing thing I was talking about is one method that clearly has an advantage for those cells, because now they have one piece of DNA that can in fact code for two proteins by simply changing how it splices. So regardless of how introns originally emerged, they certainly are taken advantage of now and put to good use on occasion. There are genes like this one, as far as I know. Nobody has ever found a function, an alternative function for these particular introns. As far as we can tell, those are just junk that's in there and has to get removed in order to actually code for the protein. But there are other examples where introns are actually put to some important use.
When you have open splicing things for these two proteins, are they open proteins?
They can be. The example where this was first discovered was in Drosophila, and it turns out there's a gene. I forget the name of the gene right now. It might be called sex. No, it's not sex. Anyway, it's a gene that's involved in determining the sex of the fly. And one of the alternative splice products, if that product is made, it becomes a female. If the other product is made, it becomes a male. And so you can have, in fact, flies that are genetically, that is, they're XX flies, and so they should be actually flies instead of XO. XO are... I'm not a Drosophila genetics. Anyway, it's similar to humans. There's one chromosome arrangement, like in humans, it's XX is a female and XY is a male. And there's something similar to that in the fly. I forget the details right now. But the point is that this alternatively spliced product is on one of those sex-determining chromosomes, and it makes these two products. And in fact, if that gene is mutant, if you knock that gene out, flies that are genetically, they should be female, actually turn into males, because it needs this product. And then so in the one form, it essentially gives rise to the downstream making a female and the other product. So it has different fates. The genes, in fact, the protein products are, in fact, very dissimilar. They're similar at the 5' end of the gene, so they have one or two exons in common, and then the rest of the whole protein are completely different, and they have different targets. They're controlled by the same promoter. There's a, the original transcript is the same. It's just a matter of how it gets spliced that ends up giving you different protein products. Complicates. Yes. Yes, I agree. Yeah. People have done that, but I guess I would argue with the statement that there are good programs for predicting secondary structure. You can actually predict structures. The question is, given an RNA sequence, you can apply methods that predict secondary structure, and the question is, how accurate are they? If the RNA is small, like a tRNA-sized gene, they actually work pretty well. But as the RNAs get bigger and bigger, of course, the number of potential structures grows exponentially with the length of the sequence, and the energy difference between, you know, the true structure and this big ensemble of potential but not correct structures grows rapidly. And so, in fact, you try to predict the structure of any large RNA by any of the best methods, essentially always wrong. The best method for predicting RNA structure actually comes from, if I have the same, or what I mean by saying, I have the same gene for multiple species, so that I know that the structure is important. So, for instance, the tRNAs, well, the tRNAs are fairly simple. Let's take bigger RNAs like a ribosomal RNA or something like that. If I have several different species that all contain that same gene, the ribosomal RNA, the way I can predict the accurate structure is by looking for covariation. If I know that, you know, in one structure I have an A here, then there must be a U here because they form a base pair. And in another species that A is changed to a G, then this U must have changed to a C such that the structure can be maintained. And so this kind of covariation analysis, where you have lots of different species that all have make the same gene, and furthermore, you know that the structure is important for that gene, so you assume that they have a common structure. That's the only accurate way to predict structures of large RNA molecules. And that has, as far as I know, not been looked at carefully for messenger RNA sequences. I think, in general, people think that the structure of a messenger RNA probably isn't important. Well, I just brought up the point, and you read it, well, it may be important in some cases for splicing things out. As far as I know, that hasn't been looked at systematically. For one thing, it may only occur very rarely. It may not be a general feature. So you'd have to first have evidence that it occurred in one specific case, and then you could look at that case in more detail. As far as I know, that hasn't been attempted. They may well have multiple structures, and especially, again, if the structure is not important, like this messenger RNA, I wouldn't be surprised at all if I make lots of copies of messenger RNA and they each fold up, they may have completely different structures because the structure is not important. For other RNAs where the structure clearly is important, like, for instance, for ribosomal RNAs, the question is, do they all fold up into the same structure? It's a question, but that's one where you can make a pretty strong argument that, I mean, there may be pieces of the structure that are really not important, and they may be variable, but there are other parts that are important for the function, and those are very likely to be conserved. There is an issue about, is the structure static or dynamic? And in fact, there's good evidence, even for ribosomal RNA, that in fact, the structure changes. I think I mentioned yesterday that it's been shown recently that it's actually the RNA part of the ribosome, which is involved in the catalysis of protein synthesis. Actually, it's the RNA that forms the enzymatic core of that activity. And there's some evidence that, in fact, the RNA goes through some motions. So that is, its structure changes during the process of protein synthesis. Yeah. I don't remember the function. I mean, it's only been observed a couple times, to my knowledge, and I don't remember the particular function of those proteins. But I know it was verified because they went actually and looked in these so-called EST libraries. That is, you're pulling out and sequencing RNA that you know is expressed, and so they actually found an expressed RNA that corresponded to this intron region on the other direction. So that's how they knew that, in fact, there was a gene going in the opposite direction that was contained within an intron of a big gene that they knew about going in one direction. But I don't remember if the function of that RNA, of that gene, was known or not. I can't answer that. Usually, but again, there are exceptions, and so this is a case in which it's you can show by that method that the intron that you've removed actually had some function. There are, in fact, in some species, I think, the requirement, this step here of splicing the RNA and then transporting it out into the cytoplasm is actually a coupled event. So if you don't splice it out, it never gets out into the cytoplasm. Even though it's transcribed, you get a nice messenger RNA sequence, it never makes it into the cytoplasm because there's a coupling between the event of splicing and the export out the nucleus. Now, that's not true in all cases. There are lots of cases in which you can take a gene that has had its introns removed, you know, copy it into double-stranded DNA, put it back into the cell. I talked yesterday about doing transformation. It will go in, it will get incorporated into the DNA, and then that gene will be expressed just fine. But it's not always true. I think it's actually in C. elegans, where this nematode worm, which is completely sequenced, where people have shown that, I think, splicing, at least, I don't know if it's true for every gene, but for many genes, you actually require splicing in order to do transport to the cytoplasm. So there's some coupling going on there. Well, actually, prokaryotes do have introns, but they're much rarer, and they're always of these self-splicing events. So many prokaryotes don't have introns at all. Some of them have some introns, but like I said, they're rare, and they're always of the self-splicing kind. But that still doesn't argue that it wasn't early, although some people would say, well, that favors the intron late stuff. But other people would say these prokaryotes, remember, have one of their, one of the things that apparently they've been optimized for is very rapid replication times. Like E. coli can replicate in half an hour or something like that. So you could argue, well, even if introns were there, just the very fact that they're there and they make the genome bigger is going to slow down the whole process. And so there's that, in case you could argue that there's a evolutionary selection pressure to get rid of them, even if they once existed. That is, bacterial genomes have been trimmed down to more or less only what's needed. I mentioned the other day that in humans, for instance, we think that essentially 90% of the DNA is junk. In a prokaryote like E. coli, it's on the order of 1% or less that isn't coding for something or other. It's a very small amount. You made one statement right at the beginning that I want to argue. There's this sort of thing about this evolutionary ladder, and you had things coming first, things coming later. What you have to say is that we have prokaryotes, and we have eukaryotes, and there was a common ancestor at some point. Okay, that common ancestor was neither a prokaryote nor a eukaryote; it was the ancestor of both. What we don't know is whether that common ancestor had introns in it that were then removed in this branch of evolution, or whether that common ancestor didn't have introns and they were acquired in this other branch. Okay, but you can't say that necessarily that eukaryotes evolved from prokaryotes. What you can say is there was a common ancestor, which we think is probably more like current day prokaryotes, although that's up to argument as well. But still, there was a common ancestor, and we don't know if that common ancestor had introns or not. You can do that stuff, and both camps, you know, use that kind of data to make the arguments. But again, you can make it in either direction. It really has to do with, you know, it's really hard to say what occurred there, and whether if they've been acquired recently, since introns are so numerous in current eukaryotes, that if they were acquired recently, they had to have a very rapid way to expand. I mean, they had to have a rapid expansion anyway, because even, you know, newly acquired genes, that is, genes that exist, for instance, in mammals and that don't exist in other vertebrates or something like that. So they're relatively recent in evolution. They have introns in them too. So regardless of where they came about, they have a way to expand. Essentially, that all genes have introns. That's a question I don't know the answer to. I think so. Ninety percent is junk. Let me make a distinction that might not have been clear from what I said before. So junk DNA is what's usually referred to junk DNA is not introns. The introns make up a small fraction of junk DNA. And so I think I didn't make this clear enough. Let's look at it. Let's say this is a big section of DNA, right? And so there's a gene here that is something that gets transcribed into messenger RNA, but it gets its introns removed. The little boxes represent the introns. And so I'm going to throw away those introns, and so in some sense, those are junk. The next gene might be down here. So this gene might be, let's say, 10 kilobases long. That was the example over there, 7 kb. That's kind of a typical size, although I said there are genes that exist actually over 500,000 base pairs. They're a very, very big genes. But this, I think, is a average size or typical size of a gene, 10, maybe 20 kb, of which maybe 50% of that may be intron sequences. The spacing between genes, on average, might be 100,000 base pairs. So this is where the 90% junk is. What's in between these genes is basically not transcribed. Well, the intron is defined as only something that gets removed after transcription. So if none of this is transcribed, even cell splicing only occurs within an RNA sequence. So it has to be transcribed before it can be an intron. Now, there may be sequences in here that look like intron sequences, and they would be spliced out if that was ever transcribed. But since it's never transcribed, the inappropriate question to ask. Okay. So what is in this 90% of the whole genome that's not transcribed, either as exons or introns? This I mentioned there are these big families of repetitive DNAs. There are big repeat sequences that are about 5 to 10 kb long. And they occur in thousands of copies in the genome. There are small repeat things that are about 120 base pairs long called ALU sequences, and they occur at 100,000 copies in the genome. And so this, the region between genes on average is just littered with this kind of junk. Okay. Now remember what I said is on average the genes are about 100 kb apart. I think that comes out right. So if there are 40,000 genes and they're 100 kb apart on average, you get this number of 4 million base pairs in the human genome sequence, right? And if a typical gene is on the order of 10 kb or something, that leaves this 90% of junk that's never transcribed, doesn't code for anything as far as we know, and so on. Now, that's an average. The distribution is quite variable. There can be regions where I have 5 or 6 genes all within 100 kb, right, clustered together, and then there can be a megabase or more of DNA with no genes in it. So it's not like it's evenly distributed where you have a gene here and then 90 kb of nothing and another gene, you know, spread out like pounds in Kansas or something like that. It's not like that. It's like that there are clusters where there are lots of genes, and there are clusters where there are no genes, and it's, I don't know if it's a random distribution or not, but it's clearly not an even distribution. Yeah, the up and down, I mean, so this certainly applies to vertebrates. If you go down to C. elegans and Drosophila, because remember the genomes are 10 times smaller, and so now we're talking about instead of 90% junk, it's maybe, I think in C. elegans the number is more like 50% junk and 50% coding. When you get down to yeast, it's again back up to where it's 80% coding, and there really isn't much in the way of repetitive sequences. So in that case, the remaining 20% is, there's some amount of introns, although introns are actually rare in yeast. The remaining 20% is mostly what I wouldn't necessarily call junk. I would say, so remember in the genome, this is the gene, that is, this is the piece of the RNA that codes for the protein. There's some region up here which is usually called the control region, where all these proteins are going to bind and turn and decide whether this gene should be turned on or off. That never gets codes for any protein, And sometimes it's included in the definition of what the gene is, and sometimes it's not. It's clearly important for the expression of the gene, but it doesn't actually code for the protein. And so I wouldn't call it junk. It's actually highly important for the expression, but it's not, doesn't end up as part of the coding sequence. So in yeast, most of the DNA can be ascribed to either coding exons, introns, or intergenic control regions, but not a whole lot of other stuff besides. What's that? In yeast? I don't know what the... Oh, E. coli is 1%, I think, of things that you can't ascribe any function to. So we don't know what it's, it doesn't appear to be control region. It's not coding. It's between the genes. But so, for instance, if this gene is going this way and there's its control region, I have another gene going this way, so here would be the coding region, here would be the control region. There's a little bit of space in between that, as far as I know, doesn't code for anything, and that would total it, would maybe represent 1% of the gene, for which I can't ascribe any particular function. I mean, that's clearly one of the things that they, I mean, every species to survive in evolution is sort of has found a niche, and it's optimized itself in that niche. I mean, we talked a little bit about evolution, and that there's going to be more about that. Evolution is clearly very good at doing local hill climbing. So if I'm in some point and I can describe a fitness surface and some fitness function, and I can do local hill climbing, evolution is very good at that. It's not so good at jumping, you know, across valleys to other hills. And so you could argue that, you know, there are lots of good niches out there that simply aren't filled by anything because there's no way to get from where we are now to there. But they're very good at doing local hill climbing. So what I think is that species like bacteria, its niche they filled is best occupied by something that grows incredibly fast. So whenever there's an opportunity for growth, I mean, so these bacteria will sit around for a long time dormant because they don't have any nutrients, but then when all of a sudden they get nutrients due to a rainstorm or whatever, it's the soil bacteria, suddenly they grow rapidly and they take over that population, and they grow faster than, and they outcompete some of the other organisms that might exist. So they've been selected for optimal growth speed, at least that's one of the criteria. That's who knows? I mean, we right now nobody knows a function for this so-called junk. I mean, so there, one of the arguments is it actually contributes to the overall structure of the chromosome. Remember, these chromosomes get, and maybe this junk is actually important in maintaining this overall complete structure. And if you were missing that, the chromosomes would somehow become less stable or something. Well, we're clearly optimized for different things. I mean, we don't double as fast as we could, right? Whereas E. coli, well, they've been selected to be efficient for doubling time.
If you look at
The problem with that is, if I take human and mouse, very closely related species, right? If I was from another planet and you gave me the DNA sequences of humans and mouse, you would probably decide they were different species, but you weren't quite sure. I mean, the DNA is very, very similar. One of the main differences between them, if I look at the chromosomes in human, you know, they have the 22 plus the sex chromosomes. In mouse, there's a different number, although it's similar. It might be 19 chromosomes. And what's happened is the chromosomes themselves have been rearranged. So chromosome 6 in human might be composed of chunks, big chunks, multi-million base pair pieces, but multiple chunks of mouse, and so they've been rearranged. So the point I'm trying to get at is it's not so easy to say, does this region of junk, does it correspond to an equivalent region of junk in mouse? Because the chromosomes themselves have been rearranged. There clearly is there an equivalent amount of junk in mouse and human, and it's easy to say that this gene in human corresponds to this gene in mouse. It's less easy to say that this piece of junk in human corresponds to this piece of junk in mouse, because the pieces of junk actually evolve much more rapidly. They don't have any constraints on them, so their sequence, they diverge faster, and furthermore, I remember this repetitive families. The repetitive families are actually different in human. They have some of them that are the same, but they also have new repetitive families. So they've expanded to more or less the same amount, but they've used the different sets of repeats in order to do that. So answering your question is not quite so easy. You might be able to do it between even in chimpanzees, things that are really closely related. Now you can actually line up the junk regions as well as lining up the genes that if they correspond. Well, I think they're generally modifications of existing genes. I mean, they typically are made up of domains that you can recognize as being similar to previous families, but they've been organized in a new way, or maybe they've been combined in some new way. That would be a very hard experiment to do in something like a mouse. I'm trying to think if they might have done it in something like C. elegans or something like that, where first of all there's less of it, so you could sort of imagine. I mean, you could imagine. I don't know whether it's been done or not. I could only answer your question whether somebody has taken, you know, two genes, removed the junk in between them, and see if those two genes still function. Okay. My guess is they probably would, but that doesn't address the question of, suppose I took a genome and I removed all the junk in that genome, and I now had a genome, for instance, in C. elegans that was only half as big as it is now, had all the same genes, but simply was missing all of that junk, and would it still be a normal worm? Could I tell the difference between these two worms? It's one that had lots of junk and one had none. And that experiment, like I said, would be very difficult to do. If half of the total genome is junk, removing all of it, or even removing the majority of it, would be very, very difficult. Well, so those kinds of things have been done in evolution. And again, I'm getting out of the area that I'm an expertise in, but I remember reading this. It was a paper I read not too long ago. Turns out there are two species of Drosophila. I don't remember the two species' names. One of whom is not the one that was recently been sequenced, but it's similar to that. It has the sort of the same size genome. And there's another one that whose genome is either 5 times bigger or 10 times bigger. And it's done a huge expansion of its junk. Well, these are two species of Drosophila. They're both healthy and they both seem fine. And so that says that it hasn't lost any capability of surviving by having this great increase in its genome size. It hasn't apparently lost or gained anything. So it's really sort of neutral with DNA. Now, that doesn't answer the question of, well, what happens if I took the amount that it's there now and I got rid of it? Would it still be okay? I don't know. But it basically says that apparently, so in other words, I don't know if there's a minimum size that's sort of required. What we know is we can add a lot more without having any big deleterious effect. How much can we trim it down? That experiment has not been done by nature, as far as I can tell. That is, there aren't two species that in which one has almost none and one has quite a bit more. So most people speculate that there is actually some function to this, and like I said, it may be just chromosome integrity or the ability to make chromosomes more condensed or whatever, and that's easy to handle, simply because there aren't vertebrates in which most of that junk has been eliminated. Now, there are vertebrates that have quite a bit less DNA than humans. One of the organisms that there's been a strong push to get sequenced is the fugu, the pufferfish, fugu. And the reason is that its genome size is something like it's a vertebrate. And so most vertebrates have more or less the same size as humans in the same order of magnitude. Its genome size is something on the order of fivefold less or so. So presumably it has most of the same genes, and it's not a mammal, so it doesn't have all the mammal-specific genes, but it has most of the genes that vertebrates have. And if its genome is really five or even more fold less than human, then presumably it's gotten rid of junk, primarily junk. And so one of the arguments for sequencing it is simply you get all the important information about all the genes in a much smaller total amount of work because you have much smaller genome. But the other issue is addressing things like, well, you know, how much is really the minimum amount of junk that's needed? Does it have a function at all? Can you trim it down to some sort of minimum size and so on? So there are, so that's one of the arguments for sequencing fugu. And that, I think, says pretty strongly that at least in some species, this is not playing any particularly important role. Yeah, I mean, that's a good argument that actually went on for a long time in the early days of the Human Genome Project. There were big camps that said, well, let's just sequence the RNA. And in fact, that was the initial impetus behind these so-called EST projects. What the EST projects are is they extract the RNA from the genome, and then they just sequence it. Now, they typically, in a single EST, you don't get the entire RNA sequence, which might be 2,000 to 3,000 base pairs long, because you just get a single sequencing read, which is typically about 500 base pairs. But the point was, if I just take all of the RNA from the cell, and I just sequence that at random, eventually I'll be able to put them together, and then I will end up knowing the sequences of all the messenger RNA. And there has been a lot of effort in that, and it's telling us a lot about the genes. And in fact, that's, in many cases, how we can know where the genes are in the DNA, because we already know that this piece is expressed. The reason that that idea wasn't... So there was actually a lot of effort put into that and quite a bit of money, and there are these big databases of ESPs, but the idea was, well, we just do that alone, we're going to miss things. First of all, we're going to miss all these control regions because they're not expressed at all. We're going to miss the junk, and people say, well, maybe that's not important. And I say, well, maybe it is. You know, so that became a cost argument, and there was actually a pretty strong argument saying, well, let's not do the junk because it's going to cost a lot. Well, it turns out the cost has come down so much that, in fact, in retrospect, most people are glad that we did the whole thing instead of just doing EST. But the main arguments were that we would miss these control regions. The other main argument is that in any one cell, or whatever cell you take, you're not going to get all the genes expressed simply because not every gene is expressed in every cell. So if you really want to get every gene, you have to look at every cell and maybe at every stage in development. So you're not going to get all the genes that way. And even if a gene is expressed in a particular cell, if it's expressed at a very low level, you may not see it because you're doing a sampling thing. And there are ways to sort of normalize the sample to get rid of the highly expressed things and look for the low expressed things. But still, if a gene is there in very small amounts, you simply may miss it, even if it is expressed in that cell. And it turns out that many of the important control genes, that is not if you're talking about actin and myosin, things that are part of muscle, those are obviously expressed in large amounts because you need lots of them. But a control gene, if I make a protein here and its function is to go and turn on another gene that's there, that gene need be present only in very small amounts. But maybe, in fact, some of the most important genes would be missed by that criteria simply because they were too low abundance to be picked up by that method. I'm giving you all the arguments that were made for why not go for the fast and cheap way, because that was the main argument for doing it that way. It's faster, it's cheaper, and we'll get most of the information that we want. And the main argument was, well, most is not good enough. We really want all of it. By and large, one of the topics we're going to get to is this so-called gene-finding method. So given a big chunk of DNA, Terry put up a page the other day that just showed you this long string of apparently a random collection of A's, G's, and T's. Well, so the human genome is like that, except imagine, if I did a calculation one time, I think it's something like 500 equivalents of the Manhattan phone book. Manhattan phone book, take 500 volumes of that and just fill it with A's, G's, G's, and T's in random order, and that's the human genome. Okay. So then the question is, well, where are the genes? How are we going to find them? So there are computational methods that look for signals. I mean, I talked about signals having to do with splice sites, and I'm going to talk in a little bit about, you know, looking for coding regions where they have certain characteristics, they code for proteins. Can you recognize them just by looking at the DNA? It turns out by computation alone, it's a pretty difficult problem. Fortunately, all these EST sequences have been generated, and that gives us, I mean, not more than a hint. It really tells us, well, there are regions that I know are genes because they actually occur in this database of expressed sequences. So I can use those and put them back on here and see where the genes are. But again, that's not going to probably get me everything. And so the question is, how good are these other computational methods? And, you know, there are arguments. Some people say, well, by combining the EST data plus these computational prediction methods, we probably know 95% of the genes or something like that. I don't know. It's an argument that won't be resolved until for some time to come. But that's one of the issues, is how good are these methods? How can we tell the genes? I'm going to describe a little bit some of the information that you can use to predict genes as we in the rest of the talk today. Okay? By and large, yeah. I mean, they have essentially the same junk, although there are these regions. The genes are nearly identical, 99.9 9% or something like that. The junk DNA is also nearly identical. There are these regions, like was mentioned, that there are, there will be a string where I have, 50 A's in a row, and somebody else might have 60 A's in a row, so there'll be sort of variation. These are called VNTR, variable number tandem repeats. So it might be, a tandem repeat in this case is just the AAA, but there might be situations where I have a GAT, GAT, GAT repeated many times, and some individuals will have 10 of those, and some individuals will have 12 of those. These are exactly the kinds of things, in fact, that people use in DNA fingerprinting and forensics, because these are, in fact, regions of the genome that are highly variable among the population. Now, so overall, the genome, the junk DNA might be 99.5% identical, but there will be these little regions that are highly variable between individuals, and if you have many of those scattered throughout the whole genome, you can use them to essentially give you a unique fingerprint of any individual's DNA sequence. And so they get used for forensic as well as other kinds of things. But again, those represent usually small things, and people have done a lot of work to try to find them amongst the whole genome so that you can use them for those purposes. But by and large, the junk DNA is just as, maybe not just as highly conserved, but it's very highly conserved, just like the coding. No, the EST data doesn't tell you where the positions are. So in fact, a lot of the information that has been used in the last 5 or 10 years, where people have done gene hunting, they've identified by looking at families with inherited diseases, breast cancer is a classic example, or Huntington's, and sort of a genetic mapping, they've located on a particular chromosome and so on. And then what they do is they might go to the EST library and say, well, which ESTs can map to that region? But that takes more experimental work. You don't get any information about the mapping from ESTs alone. But once you have the genome sequence, then not only do you know where the genes are, but you know which ESTs map to which places. I don't think so. In general, it's not thought to be true that I could rearrange things and they would be fine. As I said, if I look at human and mouse, the chromosomes have been rearranged many times. I mean, big chunks. It's not like the genes have been completely scrambled. A region of human DNA and the region of mouse DNA that contain the same set of genes are said to be syntenic. That is, they're the same region from two different species. So if I have a single human chromosome, it might be syntenic with regions of 4 or 5 different chromosomes from a mouse. That is, there have been rearrangements over time, but they tend to be big chunks. And so I could, in fact, in those regions, do the question that you were asking, compare the junk DNA from those regions. As far as we know, they don't change the function. Yeah, I mean, the event that gives rise to this, where I take a piece of one chromosome and I rearrange it to another chromosome, those occur in humans as well. They're called chromosome translocations, and many of them are associated with human diseases. You can sometimes, that's one of the things they look for in when they do amniocentesis, and you get a spread of a human chromosome. That there are certain abnormalities where chromosomes have been rearranged that are so big that you can look at them just at a microscope and you can see them. And they correspond, like I said, to certain known human diseases. But usually the reason that they correspond to a disease is because the breakpoint has actually interrupted a gene or something like that.
But if they don't affect,
there can be. It depends on how much the change is added. If the change is just a small change at the end, it probably doesn't have any effect at all. If it's a big change or something like that, a big chunk of one chromosome is made over here, then mating will have a problem, and that's actually one of the causes of sterility in some people. I mean, sometimes it's due to chromosome translocation events. It's a rare event, but there are cases that are known where that leads to sterility. That's actually thought to be one of the initial events that might lead to speciation. I mean, most speciation is thought to occur by a single population dividing in two, and then they evolve independently, and when they ever come back together, if they ever do, they've evolved enough so they're enough difference that they can't mate. Well, why can't they mate anymore? One of the reasons may be that within the population, some gene translocation event has occurred and sort of taken over that population, and so now these two are now separate species because they can't mate anymore. You can actually, I think this has been done. I remember I did a work done by Jansky quite a while ago in Drosophila, creating two species in the laboratory. There are these known translocation events. In fact, you can induce them by shining X-rays. So X-rays will break chromosomes, and the cell has a way to repair them, but it doesn't always repair them faithfully. So if I break off an arm of a chromosome, it might get stuck back to where it was supposed to be, or it might get stuck on the end of another chromosome. So I can actually generate chromosome abnormalities. Now, ordinarily, those flies would probably just go on and die because they would become they become sterile and mating with other flies. But if I do this carefully enough, I can actually maintain a population that have a set of chromosomes that have been rearranged compared to the parent population in the laboratory. And then, you know, once these things become stable within a population, that is, every member of the population has this set of things, then that becomes those flies are perfectly healthy and they'd be okay. And if I let them go in the wild, they would probably survive just fine. But they are a different species than their parent because they can't mate for this very reason, that the chromosomes don't pair properly. So you can lead to all sorts of non-disjunction events and so on. Now that, whether that's a common method of speciation is a little bit up in the air, I think. I don't know. Somebody's talking about evolution later. I should, that's not my expertise, and I probably shouldn't go out too far on limbs.
Another question, before you just saw a field, I'm going to try to say that. The principles of information as well as DNA are different from the slides. The big part of the same here is that the life of the object is different, but it's not the fact that they're gone.
Well, these events are occurring all the time in all cells that are active and living. But you know, as a cell, if a cell is dead, it's not going to do any of these things. The question is, can a cell continue to live after it ever stopped doing these things? So there are actually examples. Parts of this can certainly go wrong, and that would probably lead to the cell's death. There are so-called programmed cell death in any highly developed organism, even flies and worms and humans, during the course of development from a single egg up to things. There are cells that are created that then are programmed to die, and those particular cells have some function for a while, and then it's advantageous for the overall development that those cells go away. And that usually events, they trigger some mechanism that actually goes in and chops up the DNA. And so it starts sort of not at this end of things. It just chops up the DNA and the cells die. It's called apoptosis. And it's a programmed cell death. Accidentally, I mean, I don't know, I'm getting a bit far afield here, but there's this so-called catastrophe theory for which actually is probably relevant in things like cancer. But what happens is, in that case, it's the opposite happens. The cells don't die, they over-proliferate. They lose their control, and so they continue to divide, and then they continue to grow, and then they end up in big tumors and stuff. But oftentimes, there's some initial event, which is often the knockout of a particular gene whose function is to maintain control. And as I said, humans have not been selected to grow fast. They're selected for other reasons. And in fact, one of the important things is that they cease cell division at some point. Many of your cells in the body, probably most of them, aren't dividing anymore. They're simply long-living. And there are some that continue to divide. And one of the ways you get cancer is this thing that controls and prevents cell division gets knocked out, and now the cells start dividing uncontrollably. And that's one of the basic causes of cancer. So there are certainly ways in which this whole process can get messed up. But the particular thing you're suggesting, I don't think happens very often. I was going to mention, so there are cells, the classic example are red blood cells. So they get made in the bone marrow, you know, sort of standard cells in most ways. They make a huge amount of hemoglobin because they're going to be oxygen carriers. And then they get put out into the bloodstream, and somewhere in that process, I don't know exactly when the event happens, they actually lose their nucleus. They're anucleated cells, and so they're no longer synthesizing RNA, they're no longer making proteins. They're just become, basically it's a bag of hemoglobin that they circulate around, and they do their function, and they pick up oxygen in the lungs, and they deliver it to the cells. And those cells last, I think the half-life of a hemoglobin of a red blood cell is something, 10 days or something like that. You know, eventually the cells die and they get sloughed off, but this is all part of their function. So they can, in this case, live, if you call it living. I mean, they're not making anything anymore, they're just carriers, but they continue to be active, functional cells for another 10 days or so after they've lost their nucleus. I don't think I really answered your question, but I'm not sure I can exactly. Okay. So let's talk about this translation event. So I have a messenger RNA sequence. It has a, you know, it's just a string of RNA, A, C's, G's, and U's, and I have to translate the information to that into protein. So it turns out that much like in DNA, there's a signal that tells the ribosome. Remember, it's the ribosome is the machine that binds onto the messenger RNA. Oops, I wrote that wrong in the wrong place. There's a signal in the messenger RNA sequence that says, here's where you start translation. You start with this codon. I'll show you what a codon is in a second. This is the beginning of the protein, and I'm going to read along, and I'm going to come to a stop. And usually the entire messenger RNA sequence is not translated. It's a portion within it. So there's a signal that tells it where to start and a signal that tells it where to stop. In eukaryotes, this is actually quite simple. First of all, eukaryotic messenger RNA in general, and there are, again, rare exceptions, but in general, only codes for one protein. And the signal is generally the first AUG. Proteins always start with an AUG as the first codon. It codes for the amino acid methionine, and all proteins start with methionine. And so basically, the way the ribosome works in eukaryotes is it grabs onto this cap, little signal I told you about that gets added to the 5' end. So there's a little signal here that it grabs onto, and then it slides along the RNA until it comes to an AUG, and that's the signal to start making protein. And it goes along to the end until it comes to a called a stop codon. There are three of those, and then it stops. And then the ribosome comes apart, goes, finds another message, and does that again. In prokaryotes, it's more complicated in that there might be multiple genes within an RNA, and each one of these will have a signal. So it can't be simply the first AUG or anything like that. And the signal actually is a little more complicated. You're right. Ignore that. The signal is in the mRNA. So in fact, what should be shown here is that a single mRNA might give rise to multiple protein products, each one corresponding to a certain section. Let me see, I have a figure here, I think, showing the basic idea. Well, this is just illustrating the event that happens at initiation. So remember that the ribosome itself has these two subunits, called the 30S subunit and the 50S subunit, just having to do with their sizes. But it's the 30S subunit that's known to be involved in finding where to start. And again, just like in eukaryotes, the start is usually, not always, but usually an AUG. And there are these so-called initiation factors. What these are involved in is actually they're looking for a signal, which is not shown on here, but there's a signal which is upstream of the AUG, and that represents a binding site for the ribosome to bind onto. Once that 30S is bound there, then this tRNA, there's a specialized tRNA that is only used at the start of proteins. And that's why it's pretty much always an AUG. This tRNA has the sequence UAC, but of course it's complementary to that. And it starts with a special amino acid. It's a special form of the amino acid methionine. Then once that complex is formed, the rest of the ribosome joins the other subunit, and then it translates down the messenger RNA until it comes to a stop. So really the main difference between, two main differences between eukaryotic messenger RNAs and prokaryotics is prokaryotes may have multiple genes on a single messenger RNA, and each gene has to have its own start signal. Okay. So the start signal itself is a little more complicated. It's not actually shown in this slide, but it represents a certain sequence pattern up here, similar to the kind of sequence patterns I showed you before, that is actually recognized by the ribosome and tells it, so this is the AUG you're going to start at because it's right in the vicinity of that signal. Does a single ribosome, that's a good question, and in fact the answer is both yes and no. That is, a ribosome, when it joins onto a particular messenger RNA, but it, let's say it reads this start signal here and it goes down here and it reads a stop, can the same messenger RNA then continue on and read the next one? Oftentimes that's true. It really depends on how far apart those are. What happens is apparently, I don't think this is known in a huge amount of detail, but apparently the ribosome, when it stops and it releases the protein, it will have a certain amount of time where it kind of scan around, presumably downstream, although there's actually examples where it can actually scan upstream a little bit to find a new AUG. If it doesn't find one within a short distance, then it falls apart and goes and looks for a new message. But if it finds an AUG with the appropriate signal nearby, it will restart without falling off the message. And so that actually leads to what's called coupled translation. There are cases in which, let me expand this, there are cases in which I have a messenger RNA, so here's an AUG for the first gene, and here's a stop, and here's an AUG for the next gene, and for some reason, this second gene actually won't be translated by itself. That is, if I were to knock out this AUG or something, I wouldn't make that one. The reason probably is that the signal that it's looking for is a very weak signal, but it will be translated if this gene is translated. So in that case, it's presumed, and in fact, it's been shown that the same ribosome will stop and restart. But again, it's not a general rule that that always happens. I can also have messenger RNA with multiple genes on it, and I can have one ribosome that starts here, another ribosome that starts here, another ribosome that starts independently on different genes, simultaneously and independently. They can be done in parallel at once. Okay. So both things happen. You can stop and restart the same ribosome, or you can have multiple ribosomes translating it at once. Not always. I said, that's why I said occasionally it'll actually scan upstream and look for something. Like, there's a really, I'll show you a really common event in just a second. Let me actually put up what this is the genetic code. So this tells you, so these are all the triplets. The way this is read is this a triplet of three nucleotides in the RNA sequence. The first triplet, second, the first position of the triplet, the second position of the triplet, and then the third position is not. You have to read down, so UGU, UGC, A, and G. So again, in the same order, UC, A, G, read down for each one. So there are 64 triplets of a four nucleotide letter alphabet. And each of the triplets codes either for a particular amino acid, which are listed here, except for these three that correspond to stop. So there are three different codons, but when I come to a stop, that tells the ribosome that the protein is finished. Let go away. One of the stops is UGA. Proteins always start with AUG, or almost always start with AUG. Those things overlap. And so, in fact, a very common occurrence, to answer your question, is I have a protein that's coming along, it comes to a UGA stop, so it's reading in one particular reading frame. Remember, it's reading by triplets, three at a time. So it reads a triplet, puts in an amino acid that corresponds to that triplet, moves over, reads the next triplet, puts in an amino acid, reads the next triplet, and so on until it makes the protein. If there's an A right here, then that creates an AUG. And so it's a very common occurrence actually for a ribosome to come along, stop at this UGA, back up one nucleotide, recognize this as a start signal, now start reading a new protein, and it's in a different reading frame. So these proteins they overlap just between the start and the stop, and then they code for different proteins. And they're reading in different reading frames, right? How does it make sure that it only goes in triplets? That's a fundamentally important question, because you would make junk proteins if that wasn't maintained. So there is an intricate machinery, the details of which are not worked out, but at every step of protein synthesis, there are actually multiple GTPs that are burned up. That is, it's an energy-consuming process, a pretty expensive energy-consuming process, actually. And there's actually a proofreading event that goes in there, such that protein translation is also a pretty high-fidelity event. The error rates are something like 10 to the minus 4th that you put in the wrong amino acid in one particular point. But anyway, part of the ribosome machinery is let me put this one up. This was mostly emphasizing the initiation event. It's binding an AUG code on 30S, and it finds the tRNA comes in that particularly reads that. But notice that this tRNA is matching up with three base pairs here. Three base pairs or three base pairs. The next tRNA is going to come in, and it's going to match up with three base pairs. And what's going to happen is that, so right here, the next tRNA will come in, and then you make a fusion between the methionine and the next amino acid. Those get joined together. So now you have a protein which is two amino acids long. And then the whole ribosome shifts over by three, such that this amino acid, this tRNA that was sitting in this point, flips over to here. These sites are labeled as the P site and the A site. The names correspond to, this is the one that contains the peptide, the growing peptide chain. And this is the one that's called the so-called acceptor site, where the new tRNA is coming in. So the new tRNA comes in here. This fusion event happens where you add the new amino acid onto the growing chain, and somehow concomitantly with that, and it requires the energy of burning a GTP molecule, the whole ribosome shifts over by three. So in other words, it's both the tRNA and the message that are moving relative to the ribosome. It's not the tRNA is moving relative to the message. These are locked in step with each other because they base pair. So these two things are moving over together. Or you could think about it the other way, where this is fixed and the ribosome moves over together, but it moves over in chunks of three. That's partly because of the way the tRNA is. You know, it's the tRNA that defines the three steps here. There actually are mutants that have been, I mean, in E. coli, you can make a mutant tRNA that has a four-base anticodon. It will read four bases here. When the ribosome shifts, it'll read four for that particular. Now, you have to do this in a special case, because if you did that sort of in general, the cell would die, because most of the genes can't tolerate, you know, being read out of frame, because it would shift the whole reading frame downstream. But you can do this in a way where it doesn't work very efficiently, and you can specifically select for that event happening. Anyway, it's just been shown that three step three by three is dependent upon the three nucleotides of the tRNA corresponding to the three nucleotides of the bases. So somehow it's the tRNA jumping over. I mean, in this cartoon, there are no details, obviously, but clearly the tRNA fits into a pocket from here on the ribosome. And when this tRNA right here jumps over, it jumps into the same pocket. And so that it's that event that makes it jump three at a time. Now, is what worked out? It's, well, how that energy is used is how the burning of this GTP. So I have a GTP, I cleave off a phosphate. So that's an energy releasing step. This is a G as in guanine, just a regular nucleotide. Starts out as a three phosphates on it, and one of those phosphates, so I'm left with a diphosphate. Starts off with a triphosphate, a diphosphate. In the process of making RNA, I didn't go into this before, but in the process of both making RNA and DNA, you start off with triphosphates. The nucleotides have three phosphates, and then in the end, you only end up with one phosphate in the growing chain. There's a single phosphate that connects all the bases in RNA and DNA. So the two phosphates have been cut off and thrown away. And that's part of the energy-consuming process that drives this forward. Well, in translation, you're also consuming energy via these phosphate groups. And there are multiple steps that actually consume it. And somehow, I don't know that the details are known, but somehow this process, in other words, what it is, it's a coupled reaction, so that cleaving this phosphate off and moving on the ribosome, those two events are coupled together. They can only happen both together. And since you gain energy by doing that, that essentially drives the ribosome down. Now, there actually is one of these GTPs that actually burned as part of a proofreading step, so that it's most of the time it's a wasted GTP, because you're just checking to make sure that you put the right amino acid in. But every once in a while, it actually serves to make a correction. And so the cells, and even this is E. coli, remember, which has been optimized to grow very fast, it's willing to spend a certain amount of energy in order to make sure that it got its protein sequence correct. And that's part of the reason that the error rate is as low as it is, something like 10 to the minus 4. It's been calculated, I don't know if it's ever been shown experimentally, but it's been calculated that if you didn't do that, if you only relied on, in other words, the specificity of getting the right protein sequence here, in some sense, just depends on this base pairing. How good is this base pairing right here? And if you only measure, you know, this energy of base pairing, you would argue that you might get errors at the rate of something like 1% of the amino acids would be incorrect, at looking at the energy differences. But in fact, it's 100-fold less than that is the real error rate. That's partly due to this error correction mechanism. There's some really good paper. Actually, the person who really pioneered this stuff called kinetic proofreading is John Hopfield, who is most known in other fields, but actually in his early days in the 1970s, he sort of got into this error-correcting proofreading, kinetic proofreading stuff. And there's some really interesting papers by Hopfield on that. Again, you have to go back to the early 70s, I think, to find those. So this is genetic code. There are listed in here 20 different amino acids and 64 codons. So, it's a what's called a degenerate code or an ambiguous code. You can have more than one codon for a particular amino acid, but if they're not evenly dispersed. So phenylalanine only has two codons. Leucine has six codons. Thionine has one. Tryptophan has one. Other ones have six. Most of them have either two or four. There are some real nice sort of consistent patterns that come out of this. It turns out that this third base, for the most part, it doesn't matter whether it's an A or G. In all cases except two, here and here, you code for the same amino acid. And in every case, it doesn't matter if it's a U or C, you always code for the same amino acid. And so, in fact, you don't make a tRNA for all 64, or actually 61 triplets. The same tRNA will read these two things right there. It has what's so-called a wobble position. So a G in the tRNA here, which normally would pair with a C, also can pair with a U. So you only need one tRNA to read some sets of triplets. So that makes it a little more efficient. You don't need to have 61 different tRNAs. You need to have around 30 different tRNAs, something like that. Okay. So what I want to do is return for a moment to the issue of gene finding. Kind of messed up this figure, but if I go back, remember, because in prokaryotes, going from the DNA to the mRNA to the protein sequence, there are no splicing events in here. A typical protein in E. coli, for instance, is probably has about 300 amino acids in it. I'd say that's the average size protein. They get small. At small end, they're around 100 amino acids. There are some that are known that are actually smaller than 100 amino acids. At the big end, they can get out to 1,000 amino acids. The biggest protein in E. coli is something like 1,200 amino acids. Okay, but because there are no splicing events, it's actually quite easy to find protein coding regions in the DNA sequence. That is, just a more probabilistic argument. A protein sequence is defined, has to start with a start codon, usually an AUG, but it always stops at a stop codon. If I just take a DNA sequence and I read it in triplets, three at a time, what's the probability that I would go for 100 triplets in a row without ever seeing a stop codon? That's actually pretty low, since there are three stop codons out of 21. So in fact, in prokaryotes, you can basically look at the DNA sequence and look for these long, what are called open reading frames. There's a reading frame of three in a row that doesn't have a stop codon in it. And whenever I see one that's 100 or 200 or 300 long, that's a gene. And that just that simple criteria gives you about 95% of the genes immediately. So in fact, it's quite easy to recognize genes in prokaryotes because there's none of this splicing going on. That is, in order to code for a protein, you have to have an open reading frame, the length of the protein, and that's just unlikely to happen by chance. In eukaryotes, the system is much more complicated because of this exon-intron stuff. I have to have an open reading frame that spans across the exon, and there can't be any stop codons in one of the three frames, right? I mean, there could well be stop codons in the other two frames, but that doesn't matter. It has to be at least one open reading frame that spans across the length of the exon. But the exon itself might be pretty short. It might only be, typical size for an exon might only be 20 amino acids or so. And I don't know if that's typical, but that's certainly, there are exons of that length, only 20 amino acids. Well, now it's pretty easy to find just by chance lots of stretches of 20 in a row that don't have a stop codon in them. Okay, so what that says, if I go back to the eukaryotic DNA sequence and I try to predict where the genes are, first of all, I know that 90% of the DNA is junk, so it's not going to have genes in it at all. But if I just look for open reading frames, I find lots of open reading frames in it. So how do I distinguish what are the real open reading frames? That is, what are the real gene sequences from the spurious stuff? What I need to do is I need to put together lots of information that I know. I know that proteins have certain characteristics. They don't actually choose from the set of all possible codons with equal frequency. They tend to be biased toward using certain subsets of codons more than the other. So that's a statistical information that I can use to help me identify where the genes are. I can also look for these signals that tell me, well, here's likely to be an intron because it has an intron signal at both ends of it. And if I remove that intron, then I end up with a longer pair of exons that contain an open reading frame between them. So there are a variety of things like that that one can use to predict where genes are in eukaryotic DNA, but it's a much, much more difficult problem than it is in prokaryotes. In the early days, the best methods would get maybe 20% of the genes right. Nowadays, again, they think that they're getting up to where there are 90-95% accurate. But that's also including the fact that they have this information about these ESTs. So in fact, in some cases, they actually know where there's certain part of the DNA is actually expressed. And that, of course, is a big help in identifying the genes. Well, actually, those things are done together because what you're looking for the signals that correspond to an intron. But one of the criteria you use is that really an intron or not? Is if it's really an intron that separates two exons, is that when I fuse those together, and remember there are pretty good rules about how that intron is going to be removed. I'm going to remove starting at this GU, which is very highly conserved, and this AG. So I pull out that part. What that means is that whatever open reading frame I had in this exon has to continue in the same frame in this exon. So these two exons, when they're merged together, there has to now be an open reading frame that continues across the boundary. The boundary of the exon need not be at a codon boundary. In other words, this codon could read AGG, or it could read blank AG. In other words, the boundary of the intron could be between codons, or it could be within codons, either one. But the point is that when I fuse them together, it now has to have a continuous open reading frame. So when I'm trying to predict where the gene is, I'm both using information about these splice signals, about open reading frames in the two exons, and furthermore, the fact that when they're fused together, they have to be a continuous open reading frame. So both of those come together. That's the most highly conserved part, but remember the signal continues on a bit beyond that. So there are these other nucleotides in here are not completely conserved, but somewhat conserved. There's a statistical pattern there that I can use to help identify those junctions. Okay, so that's the code on, that's the table. I might just show you again, in case you're interested, what the amino acids actually look like. I showed you a picture of nucleotides. So these are the 20 amino acids down here. At the top, I'm just showing you the standard. An amino acid has a nitrogen, a carbon, and a carbon, where this carbon has these two oxygens on it, that nitrogen. This carbon in the middle has attached to what's called the R group. It's the R group that's different for the 20 amino acids. This part, this is the backbone part, but I make a peptide bond. I basically remove water, so I have this oxygen that gets removed along with two hydrogens attached to that nitrogen. So I fuse two amino acids together, and now I have what's called a dipeptide. Each individual of these is called a peptide. I have a dipeptide. This one has an R1. This one has here's actually three of them, an R2, an R3. And I just keep adding those up. It's the R that's different between the 20 different amino acids. And this is showing you the 20 different R groups. They fall into categories of some of them are very hydrophobic. I mean, they're just grease, basically. Some of them are charged. And so they have they give you lots of different chemical properties that the proteins can have, depending on what their side groups are. So what I want to talk about briefly for the rest of the time is something about protein structure, and I'm not going to get into much detail about this. One of the, it's often referred to as the holy grail problem of computational biology. It's actually existed much longer than computational biology is in the field, is being able to take a protein sequence and predict what its structure would be. How is it going to fold up? There are certain sort of common elements of structure that actually don't depend on the R groups themselves, or depend only partially on the R groups. Proteins like DNA and RNA can form helical patterns, and the stabilizing forces in these helical patterns actually are among the backbone. I can get hydrogen bonds along the backbone atoms. So in this picture right here, the R groups, the different amino acids, are actually sticking out to the side. They're not involved, at least usually not in any very direct way, in the forming of the alpha helix. The forces that hold the alpha helix together are hydrogen bonds among the backbone atoms themselves. So I can make an alpha helix in which the R groups on the outside are either all hydrophilic or all hydrophobic, or a really common pattern is, in fact, for an alpha helix to have hydrophilic amino acids on one face of it and hydrophobic amino acids on the other face. And then what that usually means is I have an alpha helix which is part of it is facing up against the rest of the protein, but so that hydrophobic face gets packed in against other hydrophobic molecules, and the hydrophilic face is packed is out in solution where it's interacting with water, and that presumably is part of the forces that drive the proper folding of that protein. Another common protein structure is this so-called beta sheet. Again, the forces that hold the sheet together are interactions, hydrogen bonds, which are these little squiggles here, between the backbone atoms, and now the R groups are sticking up and down, alternatively up and down. So it's another common protein secondary structure. You can have proteins that are made up of combinations of those motifs. So here's a single protein in which this is a beta sheet region. Notice that there's a certain twitch to it. But between any adjacent, an individual piece, an individual stretch of amino acids that is part of a beta sheet, that's called a strand of the sheet, or sometimes it's called a ribbon part of the sheet. Adjacent ones are sort of right next to each other so that they make these interactions. But the overall sheet could have various kinds of twists to it. So in this case, I have a beta sheet region surrounded by some alpha helices, and there are other regions of the protein that don't have either of those two structures. And those are sometimes referred to as random coils, but in fact, they're anything but random. They have a particular structure, and if I crystallize it, or even if I look at it in solution, it's not that this thing is, you know, flopping around, although sometimes they have some dynamics they can flop around, but oftentimes they're constrained to a particular structure. It's just that it's not any of these standard structures, so it's sometimes referred to as random coil. I think most people don't use that term nowadays.
Maybe a dumb question. You mentioned that the structure is determined by hydrogen bonds between the backbone and the backbone, right?
Right.
But what about the atoms in the R group?
Oh yeah, sure. But what I meant for let me clarify that, because you raised, I wasn't very clear. It's the hydrogen bonds in the backbone that stabilize the structure of the alpha helix. But hydrogen bonds on the R groups will bring one alpha helix together with another alpha helix, or an alpha helix together with something else. Let me get to my next slide. I think that's, well, I'll skip one. I'll come back to it in a second. So here's the sort of the overall picture. So the idea is I have a protein with some what's referred to as the primary structure, or just the sequence. It's the list of the amino acids in order that they exist in the protein. What's referred to as the secondary structure is the forming of those things into things like alpha helices or beta sheets or whatnot. And the driving force for that is mostly backbone hydrogen bonds, because it's the backbone interacting with itself that leads to the primarily to the stability of this. Now this alpha helix is just a part of the overall structure, and obviously the things that are sticking out from the helix, which are the R groups, those are things that then, you know, nudge up against the rest of the other proteins, the other alpha helices, the other beta sheets, and they form the interactions that gives rise to the tertiary structure. They're pretty equally stable, and I think if you look at the database of all known protein structures, they're pretty equally likely. Maybe beta sheets might be a little more common than alpha helices, but I think they're pretty similar. And then what's sometimes referred to as the quaternary structure is just that. But many proteins actually don't exist as a single subunit. They come together in multiple subunits. So a single polypeptide chain is what I refer to as a protein that gets synthesized as one unit. But an active protein, that is an enzyme, may in fact be composed of several individual protein monomers that come together in a complex. And so for many proteins, if you really want to know their function and their overall structure, you have to solve it for the quaternary structure, that is the complete complex of all the units, right? So, because it's hard and people would love to be able to do it. And the reason they would mostly love to be able to do it, I mean, you would love to be able to look at a sequence and predict its structure for several reasons. One is just, I mean, knowing the structure of proteins has been a goal of biology since at least the 40s. I think the first structures were solved by Pindrew, I think, back in about 1950. He solved insulin, maybe. It was one of the earliest protein structures ever solved. What's that? Myoglobin was the first one? Okay. And it was a huge, because it was the first time we actually got to see these things. And once you see a picture of a... No, he solved it by crystallography, right? And he solved it by crystallography, and that was the first time you got to see a molecule. And once you saw it in its three-dimensional, you could, in many cases, its function made sense. I mean, for myoglobin, it's actually... this is a hemoglobin, I think. So myoglobin is a single-chain molecule that acts like... And it actually binds... There's a heme group that binds iron, and that and then binds oxygen. And once you saw it in a picture, sort of everything made sense. It's sort of like seeing the structure of DNA. Suddenly all this phenomenology about genetics makes sense when you see the base pairing and the alpha stuff. So that's true of proteins. Oftentimes, actually seeing them in three dimensions makes sense. You understand how they work to a better degree. And then other proteins were solved. Then in about 1961 or so, Anfinsen did a very famous experiment. I think I mentioned this earlier. He took ribonuclease, I think, and he denatured it. I don't think it was by temperature. I think it was in guanidinium chloride or some denaturant, maybe just a detergent. And then you dilute out the detergent, and it folds back up, and it became active. And so from that one experiment, he concluded that the ribonuclease, at least, the information in its structure is contained in the sequence. Because before that, nobody knew. If the proper folding required energy, required other proteins, and so on. You know, and you often hear people extrapolating 1, 2, 3, infinity. Well, he went 1, infinity. He said the information required for the proper folding is contained within the sequence. Turns out that's not always true. Somebody mentioned yesterday that there are some proteins for which that's not true. You denature them and they won't refold up properly. In fact, they require chaperones or other kinds of things to fold up properly. But for many, many proteins, and I think it still is the majority, you can denature it and renature it and it will become active. That is, it remains, there is some native state which is presumably the lowest energy state. So given that it's the lowest energy state, and you know, we know all these physics of interactions between molecules, the idea was, well, we ought to be able to predict the structure given the sequence. And so efforts to do that began really with Anfinsen in 1961, and they've gone on ever since, and it has remained a very difficult nut to crack. Yeah, well, experimental means you can know it, but it's actually tedious and laborious, and furthermore, there are some proteins that after years and years of work simply have not been able to be crystallized for whatever reason. So there are a number of proteins that we don't know what their structure is. We would like to know their structure. So that's one reason, is that crystallizing, it ends up being a bit of luck. There are now in the database of protein structures, there's this database of all known crystallized protein structures. It contains maybe 3,000 proteins, but many of those are variants of the same protein. If you look at how many different proteins there are, I guess it's less than 1,000. Remember, there are 40,000 human genes, so in fact, the vast majority of proteins that we know exist, we have no idea what they... I shouldn't say we have no idea. If you can put them into a family, you can say, well, its structure is probably pretty similar to a protein that we know about. We may not know its exact structure, but we can sort of approximate it. But for lots of proteins, whole protein families, we simply don't know what their structure is. So for that reason, you'd like to be able to predict it. And of course, that need has simply... been exacerbated recently because we can now find protein sequences so much more rapidly than we could in the old days. So now there, like I said, there's 40,000 human genes, let's say, and we know the structure of a very small fraction of them. And the time it would take to actually crystallize them all, if we were even lucky enough to get crystals, might take a long time. But in the recent 15 or 20 years, actually the motivation for being able to predict it has changed somewhat, and that is in primitive area protein design. Now you'd like to say, all right, let me draw a protein structure that I would like to be able to make a protein that had this structure because I could predict it would have a certain function. Maybe I can design into the protein a pocket that it would interact with some, you know, bad chemical, and I could make a protein that got rid of poisons in the environment or something like that. Whatever purpose I could make. In fact, one of the really interesting things is to make a protein that specifically attacks some virus or something like that. So, you know, there are a lot of reasons why you might want to design a protein. The question is, suppose I could think about a protein that I want to design and what that protein would look like, can I come up with a sequence that will fold into that structure? So that's sort of the reverse problem of... Well, I might do that, and that's in fact the way it's usually done now, is you take a protein that either... So there are several questions here that are all closely related. So typically the way, and the pharmaceutical industry invests a huge amount of money in this, is you take a protein with a known structure and function, and you'd like to modify that protein to have a slightly different function, maybe have a slightly different target that it interacts with. So I take its known structure and sequence, and I say, okay, let me just modify this a little bit, and presumably it will work in some new way. And sometimes that works, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes what I think is a small modification to the protein sequence actually makes it misfold completely. So that's a real downer if you put $100 million into this and all of a sudden it doesn't work for some reason. But sometimes you'd like to actually make it do something that's not very similar to what it did, but actually quite a bit different. And so it might take more than a minor tweak of the protein. It might take a major rearrangement. The other thing is I might want to design proteins that are not similar to anything that's known. I might want to come up with proteins with whole new functions. And even if I could design, you know, what a protein would look like that would have some whole new function, that begs the question of how can I come up with a sequence that will fold into that structure. So there are a variety of reasons for why it has become what's considered to be a very important goal that has simply eluded the largest. I don't want to think that we haven't made any progress, but I would say for most proteins, there's an annual competition that goes on now. It started about 4 or 5 years ago, called the CASP, competition to the assessment of protein structure prediction or something like that. So groups that are doing crystallization and solving protein structures, they will, before they publish their results, before they let the results of what the real structure is, they will submit to this competition the sequence of the protein. And then all these different groups who are making protein structure prediction programs take those sequences and they predict all the structures, and then by the competition is always ends in December, I think it's every other year. They get to compare their predictions to the real structure because at that point they know it, right? In years past, people would make outlandish claims. Oh, I predicted the structure of this protein. Well, it turns out they already knew the structure. They pretended like they didn't know it, and they made an algorithm that would in fact predict it. And so it was really difficult to evaluate how good these methods were. And if you looked in the literature at, you know, claims of their performance, they varied widely. And somebody would say, oh, my method can predict 90% of all proteins. Someone else would take their program and give it a different test set and say, oh, it only predicted 40% of the protein structure. So this competition has become actually a popular thing. And over the years, and one of the reasons it's popular is when you get embarrassed because your method does really badly, it gives you a big incentive to go back and figure out why it was so bad or what could be better. And so it's actually, the prediction rates have improved. They also they classify the programs into different categories based on what their goal is. So they're so-called ab initio folding, where you just get a sequence and you try to fold it up based on physics alone. There are other ones that are based on homology folding. So you take your sequence, you look in the database for other proteins that this one is probably related to because it has enough sequence similarity. Then you assume that it has a similar structure, but you don't really know what the structure is exactly, and you try to predict what its actual structure is. That's obviously an easier problem because you have a sort of a template to go on. There are so-called threading methods. One of the methods for doing that is threading. Is you have a sequence, and it does actually fold into a structure of some existing protein, but its sequence is so far diverged that you can't actually recognize it by sequence similarity. So then what you do is you take the sequence and you try to thread it through all the other structures. And you see, if I take this sequence and I thread it through this structure, and then I calculate its internal energy, you know, based on the fact that it makes nice, you know, positive, negative amino acids are near each other, I have hydrophobic pockets, all that kind of stuff, you know, would I predict that this sequence could fold into that structure? Of course, the threading problem itself is difficult because it's not simply a threading of a... If I have a core structure and I want to thread an amino acid sequence to it, I have to always allow for the fact, well, this sequence may have little bulges. It may have a new domain that's missing from that, and so I have to sort of insert gaps or make deletions in my sequence compared to that structure. So it's not a non-trivial problem, but that's another category of methods that people use to try to predict protein structures. Anyway, over the years, the methods have gotten better, but they're still far from 100% accurate, and especially the difficult problem of ab initio folding, I think, is the main very difficult problem. So. All the people working in the field hope not. I don't work in the field, so I don't know.
This is the one time in the whole story where it's the nation, it's the one place that's built.
Well, right. Information theory and real fundamental physics. I mean, the people who were in this area, protein structure,
no,
are mostly...
No, what I mean is just one step. Uh-huh. This is the one place in the whole story where information becomes...
Right, but you could argue that the DNA contains information, and there's a variety of steps which end up where you just start. You started from this point, going from this sequence to this structure. Oh yeah, right.
Once you got the protein,
right.
Really important.
Right.
The folding is where it goes.
Right.
Right.
Of course, I didn't emphasize a lot, but remember there were RNAs that also fold up in order to perform their function. So you could say the same thing here. You have an RNA sequence that folds up into some particular structure, and that structure provides its function. For most RNAs, for mRNAs, that's probably not the case. They're information.
Sure. I mean, RNA is very important in the vector. That's a beneficial step.
Right. Where the hardware goes back and influences the software again. So the protein's going back, right. I mean, so the proteins, by and large, are doing most of those functions, but many of those functions are themselves information transfer events, turning on and turning off genes. I didn't show, there was one slide that I brought, and maybe I left it upstairs. It's actually a slide that Terry showed before, but it had to do with this network design. I don't think I brought it with me. No, I didn't. But anyway, it sort of emphasizes this point. I mean, we've talked about the information flow from the DNA down through the protein, and the protein folds up and does these functions, and so that's a whole information flow. Then, of course, this is a living system that's replicating itself, and there's all this stuff where these proteins go back, and I mean, there's a lot of feedback going on. There's a whole network design systems where the proteins in some cases, in many cases, are responding to signals in the environment and so on, and those are going back and influencing which proteins get made in the next round of replication or the next round of synthesis. And so it's a very, the whole thing is I guess it's obvious to say it's a dynamic system that has lots of variability in how it functions, how it proceeds. One of the things we'd like to know is, if you just look at the DNA as the underlying program, what kind of behaviors can that program exhibit in the context of the environment that it's in? That's really sort of a wrap-up of the things I meant to talk about. Let me just emphasize in closing that what I've given in these three lectures is really, you know, basic biology 101, but instead of taking 9 months, I gave it in three lectures. Obviously, I skipped a lot of stuff, but I tried to highlight, I think, the things that are most important to sort of the fundamental, the most important information molecules, at least in biology, are the DNA, the RNA, and the protein, and try to give you an idea of how they're made, what they look like, what some of their functions are, and the rest of the semester of this course has to do with some of the issues I've touched on here, as well as other things. A lot of things having to do with interactions of these components with each other, and I just really briefly touched on. And so hopefully, if you didn't already know all this stuff, and hopefully nobody knew everything I said, if you didn't know a lot of stuff, you have a little bit better background in which to proceed. But there is the underlying question that's been brought up on occasion already. We talked about it last night. You know, what's the actual connection to physics? Why would, especially theoretical physicists, be interested in some of this stuff? What can they contribute? And I'm not going to give you the answer. I want to raise the question and maybe get the discussion going. Certainly, we biologists have borrowed a lot in terms of methodology from areas of statistical physics, certainly in terms of programs and computer programs and mathematical approaches we borrowed from theoretical physics. But the question was raised last night, well, what are the fundamental principles that are unknown and underlying some of these processes, and how do physicists help us solve those problems? And again, I don't have the answers, but hopefully in the next 4 months, if not immediately, we can start addressing some of those questions. And I don't think there's anything more to say. We can wait for lunch, or if anybody has more questions or comments, we can do that now. There's another talk this afternoon at 2, right? This afternoon and tomorrow morning are two talks on evolution. I talked a little bit about evolution, and based on questions, I ended up going into more of it than I had intended to, and probably more of it than I'm qualified to. But presumably everything I told you that was wrong will be straightened out later, or the questions that I couldn't answer will be answered for you later on today. Anyway, thanks for your attention.